Second illusion is failure exists. The idea that God's will, assuming that God has one, could not be done runs counter to everything you thought you knew about God. Namely, that God is all-powerful, ever-present, the supreme being, the creator, but it is one that you nevertheless enthusiastically embraced. This produced the highly improbable but very powerful illusion that God can fail. God can desire something, but not get it. God can wish for something, but not receive it. God can need something, but not have it. In short, God's will can be thwarted. This illusion was quite a stretch, for even the limited perceptions of the human mind could spot the contradiction. Yet your species has a rich imagination, and you can stretch credibility to the limit with amazing ease. You have not only imagined a God with needs, you have imagined a God who can fail to have his needs met. How have you done this? Through the use of projection. You have projected yourself upon your God. Once again, an ability or quality of being which you have ascribed to God has been derived directly from your own experience. Since you noticed that you could fail to obtain all the things that you imagine you need to be happy, you have declared that the same is true of God. From this illusion, you have created a cultural story which teaches that the outcome of life is in doubt. It could work out or it could not. It might be okay and it might not. It will all be fine in the end, unless it isn't. Adding doubt to the mix, doubt that God could meet his needs, assuming I had any, produced your first encounter with fear. Prior to contriving this story of a God who could not always get his way, you had no fear. There was nothing to fear. God was in charge. God was all power, all wonder and glory, and all was right with the world. What could go wrong? But then came the idea that God could want something and actually not get it. God could want all of his children to return to him in heaven, but his children themselves, by their own actions, could prevent this. Yet this idea, too, strained credibility, and again, the human mind saw the contradiction. How could God's creations thwart the Creator if the Creator and the creations were one? How could the outcome of life be in doubt if the one producing the outcome and the one experiencing it were the same?
Clearly, there was a flaw in the second illusion. This should have revealed the idea of failure to be false. But humans knew at some very deep level that they could not give up the illusion, or something very vital would come to an end. Again, they were right. But again, they made a mistake. Instead of seeing the illusion as an illusion and using it for the purpose for which it was intended, they thought they had to fix the flaw. It was to fix the flaw in the second illusion that the third illusion was created. The third illusion is disunity exists. The only escape from the conundrum of the second illusion was to create a third. The Creator and the creations were not all one. This required the human mind to conceive of the possibility of the impossible, that that which is one is not one, that that which is unified is really separate. This is the illusion of disunity, the idea that separation exists. Your species reasoned that if creations were separate from the Creator, and if the Creator allowed the creations to do whatever they pleased, it would then be possible for the creations to do something that the Creator did not want them to do. Under these circumstances, the will of the Creator could be thwarted. God could want something, but not get it. Disunity produces the possibility of failure, and failure is only possible if need exists. One illusion depends upon another. The first three illusions are the most crucial. So important are these illusions, so key are they in supporting the rest, that separate cultural stories were assigned to them in order to explain them and to assure that they would be explained clearly and often. Each of your cultures created its own special story, but all of them made the same basic points, each in their own way. One of the most famous is the story of Adam and Eve. It is said that the first man and the first woman were created by God and lived happily in the Garden of Eden, or paradise. There they enjoyed eternal life and communion with the divine. In exchange for this gift of life idyllic, God is said to have required only one thing. "Do not," he commanded, "eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil." According to this legend, Eve ate of the fruit anyway. She disobeyed orders. But it was not entirely her fault. She was tempted by a serpent, who in reality was a being you have called Satan, or the devil. And just who is this devil? He is, one story has it, an angel gone bad, a creation of God who dared to want to be as great as his creator. This, the story says, is the ultimate offense, the supreme blasphemy. All creation should honor the creator and never seek to be as great or greater. In this particular version of the main cultural story, you have deviated from your normal pattern by ascribing to me certain qualities that are not reflected in human experience. Human creators actually want their offspring to strive to be as great, if not greater, than they. It is the greatest pleasure of all healthy parents to see their children reach and exceed their own station in life and to surpass their own achievements. God, on the other hand, was said to have been dishonored by this and deeply offended. Satan, the fallen angel, was cast away, separated from the flock, shunned, damned, and suddenly there were two powers in ultimate reality, God and Satan, and two places from which they operated, heaven and hell. It was Satan's desire, according to the story that developed, to tempt humans to disobey the will of God. God and Satan were now in competition for man's soul. And fascinatingly, this was a competition that God could lose. All of this proved that I was not an all-powerful God after all, or that I was all-powerful but didn't want to use my power because I wanted to give Satan a fair chance, or that it wasn't about giving Satan a fair chance, it was about giving human beings free will. Except that if you exercised your free will in a way I did not approve of, I would hand you over to Satan, who would torture you for eternity. Such are the convoluted stories that have grown into religious doctrine on your planet. In the story of Adam and Eve, many people believed, "I punished the first man and the first woman for Eve's eating of the forbidden fruit by casting them out of the Garden of Eden. And, if you can believe this, I punished every other man and woman who ever lived after that, burdening them with the first human's guilt and sentencing them to also be separate from me throughout their lives on earth." Through this and other equally colorful stories, the first three illusions were conveyed in a dramatic fashion that children in particular would not soon forget. So successful were these stories in injecting fear into the hearts of children that they were repeated over and over to each new generation. Thus, the first three illusions were deeply embedded in the human psyche. 1. God has an agenda. Need exists. 2. The outcome of life is in doubt. Failure exists. 3. You are separate from God. Disunity exists. While the idea that need and failure exist is crucial to the rest of the illusions, the idea that disunity exists has the most impact on human affairs. The impact of the third illusion is felt by the human race to this day. If your thought about the third illusion is that it is true, you shall have one experience of life. If your thought is that it is not true, but is in fact an illusion, you shall have another. These two experiences will be dramatically different. Currently, nearly everyone on your planet believes the illusion of disunity to be real. As a result, people feel separate from God and separate from each other. The feeling of separation from me makes it extremely difficult for people to relate to me in any meaningful way. They either misunderstand me or fear me, or they beg for my help, or they deny me altogether. In so doing, humans have missed a glorious opportunity to use the most powerful force in the universe. They have subjected themselves to lives over which they imagine they have no control, under conditions they think they cannot change, producing experiences and outcomes they believe they cannot escape. They live lives of quiet desperation, offering up their pain, suffering it gladly, believing that their silent bravery will earn them sufficient favor to get into heaven, where they will receive their reward. There are many reasons that suffering without undue complaining may be good for the soul, but ensuring one's reward in heaven is not one of them. Courage is its own reward, and there can never be a good reason to cause other people suffering, which is what complaining does. The master, therefore, never complains, and so limits the suffering outside of himself and inside as well. Yet the master does not refrain from complaining in order to limit suffering. But because the master does not interpret the experience of pain as suffering, but simply as pain. Pain is an experience. Suffering is a judgment which is made about that experience. The judgment of many is that the pain they are experiencing is not okay and should not be occurring. Yet the degree to which pain is accepted as perfect is the degree to which suffering in life may be eliminated. It is through this understanding that masters overcome all suffering, although they may not escape all pain. Even people who have not achieved mastery have experienced the difference between pain and suffering. An example of this might be having a badly aching tooth pulled. It hurts to have the tooth pulled, but it is a very welcome pain. Their feeling of separation from me prevents humans from using me, calling upon me, having a friendship with me.
Harness.